I could have your attention, please. We're going to get started. As normal reminder, if you would please turn off your mobile phones if you haven't already done so. I'm also just going to mention one upcoming event on Monday. Brian Brown, founder of the Shogi Group, is talking about the new economy of equity trading. It's a very busy month for us. There are other events on the calendar, but you can see those on the website. But Brian Brown's talk will be this coming Monday. Today, I just want to start off on a bit of a sober note. This is the first club function we've had since one of our colleagues, the Japanese cameraman for Reuters, Hiro Muramoto, was killed in Bangkok at the weekend. And also, we've had news this morning of what looks like to be a pretty serious earthquake in Qinghai, although we hope not nearly as serious as what struck Sichuan 2 years ago. So if you just take a few seconds to remember the victims of those tragedies. Thank you. On today's event, we'll be talking about demographic change and the future of American politics with two leading experts in this area, both from different sides of the political spectrum. David Frum, well, I was going to tell you that he's the second speaker we've had in as many weeks from the American Enterprise Institute after John Bolton spoke here last week, if I remember. David is no longer with the American Enterprise Institute for interesting circumstances, which I'm sure will come up. He's the author of Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again, a regular commentator on Public Radio's Marketplace and columnist for The Week and Canada's National Post, very well-known commentator in Washington from the conservative side. We're going to start with the gentleman seated appropriately on his left, however, Rui Teixeira, who's a senior fellow at both the Center for American Progress and the Century Foundation. His recent book is Red, Blue, and Purple America, The Future of Election Demographics. And Rui is going to start. Just a quick note about the logistics of this. With two speakers, we have to be very conscious of time. So they're both going to have 10 minutes to present their views. Rui is going to come up and do it from the podium because he does have a presentation here. I'm also going to be a little bit rude and remind them both when they have 2 minutes left. So we do allow enough time for discussion afterwards. And as always, we will try and wrap up right at 2 o'clock because they have a very busy schedule. I should add that both Mr. Frum and Mr. Teixeira are here as basically guests of the U.S. consulate, and we appreciate the U.S. consulate's help in bringing them to the club. But the U.S. consulate is a hard taskmaster. They've got two events to do in Macau later today. Then they will come back to Hong Kong, and tomorrow they're straight off to China to take their show on the road there. So I thank both gentlemen for coming to the FCC today, and Mr. Teixeira, thank you.
Thanks, Tom, and thanks to you all for coming. I really appreciate you showing up to hear our little roadshow. We're getting pretty good at this. I think pretty soon David will be able to give my presentation, and I'll give David's presentation. But we'll do the orthodox thing today, and I'll give my own presentation. 8 big trends that are reshaping American politics. Given that I've only got 10 minutes, maybe more like 5.5 trends that are reshaping American politics. But one way to think about what I'm going to say today is to think about the way American politics has kind of fluctuated in the last period of time. We had George W. Bush as president, that Bush-era conservatism with a pretty aggressive unilateral approach to foreign policy, a pretty aggressive hardline conservative stance toward domestic policy issues. Let's just lower taxes. Let's keep government as small as possible. And, of course, a pretty conservative stance of his party on social issues, things like gay marriage and so on. This is all bad, 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 and we must hold the line against the encroachments of modernity. Since then, we've had Barack Obama get elected in 2008, a very different kind of politics, a much more liberal politics, a much more expansive attitude toward the role of government and toward domestic programs. Famously, he just passed Congress, and he passed and he signed the biggest piece of domestic social legislation since 1965, and Medicare, that is to say the new Health Care Reform Act. And there's a number of other pieces of activism that he's gotten going in the United States. Famously, he also has a different and more cooperative approach toward foreign policy than the Bush administration did. And, of course, the party he represents has a much more liberal and tolerant attitude toward social issues. That was 2008. He's still president, but since then we have seen the rise of the Tea Party movement and, again, this resurgence of a sort of hardline conservatism on the right that is threatening the administration. And we do expect the GOP at this point to make significant gains in the 2010 congressional election. So that's by way of context to say, well, what can we really expect in the future going forward in the sort of the medium term, not just the next election, but moving forward? What kind of politics can we expect between these two choices, Bush-style conservatism and Obama-style liberalism or progressivism? And that's really what my presentation is about, to acquaint you with some trends that help give us an answer to that question. So the first trend of my eight big trends is the minorities in the United States. This tells you how minorities vote. 80% for Barack Obama. This is blacks, Asian Americans, and Hispanics. And they're growing. The share of the minority vote went from 15% to 26% over the last 20 years. That's a rise of about half a percentage point a year. Will that continue over time? I'm glad you asked that question. And the answer is yes. These are the population projections from the Census Bureau show you that by the time we get to 2050, only 46% of America will be non-Hispanic white. Hispanics will double to 30%, and minorities will be 54% of the population. The date at which America will become a majority minority nation at this point looks to be about 2042. So you get more and more minorities in the electorate. Minorities support Obama and his style of politics. That's significant. Another thing that's going on is that white college graduate voters, who used to be quite conservative, whites with a high level of education, they become increasingly liberal, they're very liberal on social issues. They have a support for kind of a moderate style of government activism. They're becoming less and less Republican. That's true in the states. It's true nationally. And that's what this chart shows you. Obama nearly hit the break-even point with this group in 2008. And here's the sort of good news for the GOP, is that the white working class is the bulwark of GOP conservative support, and it actually hasn't wavered too much over the years. This chart shows you that in 1988, Michael Dukakis lost by 20 points to George Bush Sr. In 2008, Barack Obama still losing by 18 points to John McCain. However, this slide shows you what the problem with that is. Every year, there's less of the white working class. 15 percentage point decline in the share of voters that are the member of this social group since 1988. That's a decline of about 0.75 percentage point per year. Their place is being taken by substantially more liberal white college graduates and much more liberal minority voters. That's a fact of great significance going forward. Let's race on to my fourth trend. This trend is the younger generation, what we call the millennial generation in the United States. You maybe heard the term. These are voters who were born in 1978 or after, according to my categorization. And this is the first year in which millennials were entirely composed the 18 to 29-year-old age group. They voted 66 to 32 for Barack Obama. That's pretty notable. They are, in fact, extremely liberal on social issues. To them, issues of race, gay marriage, gender, and so on are of no account. They really don't care. We should all get along, and it's silly for people to fight about these kinds of issues as a general stance. They're also quite liberal on domestic policy issues, great supporters of health care, great supporters of a fairly healthy government activism in the domestic sphere, and they're actually much more oriented toward a cooperative and multilateral stance in foreign policy, very friendly to immigration, friendly to the rest of the world in a way that contrasts with older, more conservative generations. So there's more of them every year in the electorate. This chart shows you how fast the number of millennial eligible voters is going up in the electorate. They're adding about 4 million eligible voters a year in the United States. So by the time we get to 2020, there'll be 90 million of them in the electorate. And the percentage of the electorate that's eligible electorate that's millennials will go up from 23 ultimately to 39%. So by the time we hit the presidential election of 2020, 2 out of 5 voters in the United States will be from this very liberal millennial generation. So that's obviously of great significance too. How am I doing on time? Okay, I gotta race through these last 4 trends. The 5th trend I wanna flag is what's happening with the female population. As you know, women in the United States are substantially more progressive and democratic oriented than men. This shows you there are some particular groups where that's really exceptionally strong. Single women or unmarried women, 70% for Barack, 75% single working, 65% I estimate for college graduate women. And that's where a lot of the growth is taking place in the female population. The weight of relatively liberal, relatively progressive women is shifting toward unmarried women, single working women, and highly educated women. And all of them are growing at pretty rapid paces, especially the college graduate women, more than tripled in terms of their proportion of adult women since 1970. And that's another factor starting to move the country, continuing to move it into sort of Obama-style politics direction. Trend number 6, the professionals. This is the most liberal, progressive of all occupational groups, very liberal on social issues, very opposed to sort of foreign policy adventurism, supportive of a certain kind of moderate style of government activism, not enthusiastic about shrink the government until you could drown it in a bathtub, as Grover Norquist famously put it. And the professionals are giving more and more of their vote to the Democrats. I estimate that in 2008, it was 68%. Back in 1960, when Richard Nixon was running, that's who they were giving their votes to. Professionals that essentially realign from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party. And what's more, they're growing. This shows you the percent, the growth of the professional share of the workforce, only about 7% in the 50s. By the time we get to the middle of this decade, there'll be about a fifth of the workforce. So it's the fastest growing occupational group in the United States. Trend number seven is what you might call the rise of religious diversity, or you could call this the non-Christian coalition. These are voters who don't go to church, 67% for Barack, Jewish, other religions, 73%. And how about here? These are voters who have no religion at all. They're unaffiliated, they're secular, they just don't really participate in religion in the way people used to in the past. And as it happens, what's growing in the United States, despite all that we hear about white evangelicals, and despite all we hear about America being a relatively religious country, which is true in international terms, but the fact of the matter is the mix of religious observance and identity is shifting toward these kinds of categories, like the people who basically never show up at church, going up from 29 to 42%. Over that time period,
2 minutes,
the fastest growing religious group in the United States, those people who are secular, who are unaffiliated. You can see the steady rise over time. The estimate is that by 2024, there'll be about 1 in 5 people in the United States will be seculars or unaffiliated. There's another estimate that has it even higher. So again, we're shifting toward a type of religious identity observance that tends to advantage of a Barack Obama style of politics. And just putting it together for fun, the race and religious categories, sorry, Pat Buchanan, we're not going to be a white Christian nation much longer at this rate. In fact, I estimate by about 2018, at the latest, I think, we'll cease to have been a white Christian nation. And by the time we get to 2040, only about 35% of the U.S. population will be white Christian. So that's another thing to kind of ponder and a fun fact to share at parties. The final trend here is what's happened is the largest, most densely packed areas in the country. Increasingly in America, density equals Democrats. These are the largest metro areas, 1 million or more in the United States, a 21-point shift toward the Democrats over time. Somewhat smaller metro areas, 250,000 or more, a 15-point shift. And you know what? That's where all the people live. 54% live in large metro areas. 2/3 of the growth in the American population going forward to our next 100 million, which will be faster than China, is going to be in these large metro areas, these kind of almost megapolitan areas where you have jammed together groups, metro groups of 5 million or more. Another 20% live in the somewhat smaller metro areas. Here's where the Republicans are doing well. Here's where the conservatives are doing well. The deep rural areas, Problem is, folks, not too many people live there. Sometimes more cows than people. So that's the big trends that I wanted to bring to your attention in trying to answer this question. Are we going to have more Obama-style politics in general on net in the future, or more Bush-style politics? I think these data seriously and strongly suggest Obama-style politics is the future of the United States. Not every election, but I think on balance. And I think what that means is the Republicans are going to have to move to the center because they can't survive politically by just appealing to their base groups. They're going to have to compete for these growing groups in the electorate. I think we're going to see an end to the culture wars, these kind of sort of bitter conflicts about things like gay marriage and religion. I think we're going to see a more active government in general, and I think we're going to see a more cooperative foreign policy as opposed to kind of unilateralist U.S. approach to the world. So those are my eight big trends, and those are my implications, and I'll turn it over to my colleague, David Frum.
Rui, thank you very much. David, my timepiece is out of gas, but keep an eye on David. So,
there you go.
Thank you. Watching Rui move faster and faster through those slides reminds me of watching one of those group tours that is behind schedule, moving through the Louvre. By the time we get to the 20th century art, we are moving through it at 10 seconds to the room. I am delighted to be here in Hong Kong. I've never had a chance to visit the city before. I thank the U.S. consulate, and I'm very thrilled to be here in the legendary Foreign Correspondents Club. Let me suggest that a different way to think about motion in the electorate. Rui sliced the electorate into slices according to demographic group. I'd like to invite you to think about the same people moving through time. I'm sure you've heard the cliche about that when you're young, you move from the young man who is a socialist, the old man who is a conservative. At least for partisan affiliation, it is not true that we change as we get older. We may become more conservative as we get older, but we become more conservative, at least in the United States, within the same party. You can see, depending on what was happening in the world when people were young, you can see the echo of those events in cohorts across time. And when you break the electorate into five-year segments, you can see huge differences between five-year groups as to whether they're more Republican or more Democratic. Until recently, the most Democratic group in the electorate were people who turned 20 between 1945 and 1950. Now, when you think about it, it's understandable why that should be so. There had been a terrible recession at the end of the First World War. Most economists at the time had predicted a similar terrible recession at the end of World War II. It didn't happen. Instead, there were jobs, there was the GI Bill, and it was President Harry Truman who presided over it all. And people who were young and impressionable when that experience occurred carried the memory of it with them through the rest of their lives. And to this day, their voting behavior is influenced by that. They're about 8 points more likely to be Democratic than they are to be Republican. By contrast, the most Republican group in the electorate are people who turned 20 between 1985 and 1990. They're about 7 points more Republican than Democratic. What happened with those people? Well, they were young. They were children during the Carter era, inflation, malaise, urban decay. They were young and impressionable when Ronald Reagan was president. They saw Reagan policies deliver, put an end to the inflation, get job growth going, and also bring about the tremendous foreign policy success of the end of the Cold War. Today, all of this is provisional because the people who have turned 20 since 2000 are far and away the most lopsidedly partisan group in the electorate, as Rui says, and they are dramatically more likely to be Democratic than Republican. But I want to suggest that we shouldn't think of this as in the nature of things, but we should think of this as a result of a sequence of three experiences that happened to members of a generation. The first is a crisis. Great American political realignments are born out of crisis. The Civil War, the Depression, the great inflation of the 1970s, the great recession of today. The second element is the perception of a failed presidency belonging to one party. And that is the thing that causes young people to break with the political views that they've absorbed from their parents. Your parents may have been Democrats, probably they were, but if you were young when the Union was cracking up and you saw the inadequacy of the Democratic Party to that challenge, you were ready to turn turn to a new alternative. In the same way, if you were a Republican and young in 1930 or 32, you were ready to break with the faith of your parents. The same thing happened in the 1970s, and so in the 2000s, that under Iraq, under the slow growth in incomes, even before the recession and under the shock of the Great Recession, the current generation of young people, fairly or unfairly, came to a conclusion that George Bush was a failed president and they were ready for something new. But the third piece, after crisis and the perception of failure, is the perception of success. That you must then be exposed to a president of a different party who seems to you to succeed, as Lincoln seemed to succeed, as Abraham Lincoln seemed to succeed, as Ronald Reagan seemed to succeed, as question mark. And this is the great question over the future of the American electorate. In one of our earlier outings, I compared the voter to a laboratory mouse in an experiment who presses the blue button and gets a zap, and then presses the other button and hopes to get a pellet. Now, historically, what has happened is that people who've gotten a zap from pressing one button press the second, and they believe, at least, that they have gotten the pellet. What we have not had is the experience of two consecutive zaps from two different colored buttons. Given the continuing extremity of the economic difficulties in the United States, we do see a revival in overall growth, but we are seeing very sluggish job growth. To put this in some contrast, the recession that shaped my generation, the Reagan generation, touched bottom around Christmas time of 1982. In the 12 months of 1983, the unemployment rate dropped by 2 points. And in the 12 months of 1984, the unemployment rate dropped by another point and a half. That's why people felt it was morning in America. The economy was taking off like a rocket. And not only that, but you had two other events that happened at the same time that were maybe not important in quantitative terms, but had a big psychic impact. And they were the rollout of the IBM PC in 1982 and the arrival of the first Mac in 1984. If the question was, what are Americans going to make if they don't make cars and steel anymore? It wasn't that everybody went and became a computer programmer, as Walter Mondale scornfully said to Gary Hart. But if you were young in those years, you had a vision of possibility, and you understood what Reagan was talking about when he talked about being open to the possibilities of the future, not trying to protect the past. That, there is no such feeling of what that future could look like in the United States today. We have youth unemployment of almost 20%. We are deep now into 2010. The recession has touched bottom. We are into a recovery, and yet we are not seeing significant job growth. And all of these projections into the future depend on whether the current generation of young people have that same conclusion about this Obama presidency. So far, they don't have much reason to do so. And that means, I think, that the future remains very, very open for somebody with a better idea. Thank you.
And bang on time. Thank you very much, David. I wonder if, start with you, could we talk a bit more specifically about beyond hoping for Obama to match Bush's perceived failure with his own, what can the Republicans do to capture demographic, to make inroads in demographic areas where that seem to be moving against them? And are you hopeful that they'll be able to do that? And I wonder maybe if you could relate it to your own recent experience with at the American Enterprise Institute, and whether or not just conservatism is moving in a direction that will actually make it less palatable to the electorate in coming election years.
Oh my gosh, I'll be talking all afternoon. I'm not hoping that President Obama does badly. I'm just raising, that's the pattern that we have to consider. Republicans have been trying to cope with the trends that Rui points out through the Bush years. And here I want to dissent from something that Rui said. The thing to understand about George W. Bush is that George W. Bush did not think he was being an ultra-conservative president. He thought Newt Gingrich had tried to be an ultra-conservative Republican, and he was, in fact, looking for a new kind of coalition. Now, all of these numbers are very familiar to Republicans and conservatives, and they point to two different paths toward the future. One path, and this is the path that the president, advised by Karl Rove, took. He said, look, we're doing well among mid-market and down-market whites. But that is not going to be a majority for very much longer. What we need to do is to try to reach laterally and bring in mid-market and down-market Hispanics to join our coalition. Disparate, nice to have black votes, but we don't think there's much hope for that for a lot of complex historical reasons. But we Rove and Bush believe they could make an approach to the Hispanics. And that explained the very loose spending of the Bush years, because they were trying to build, and it turned the Republicans, in effect, into a Christian Democratic Party, socially conservative on abortion and gay rights, which they presumed would appeal, which they, with bad data, thought would appeal to Hispanic voters, economically activist and staunchly hawkish and patriotic. That's what would hold the that white working class vote. I think that my own view, argued in a lot of books and argued at the time, was that's not a very plausible political formula, that you're not going to succeed in that lateral move, and it's not a formula for good governance, which is also more important. And if the most important thing, if I am right, the most important thing is success, that's what gets you reelected, then if you have this formula, this Christian Democratic formula, it's not going to work very well and it's not going to yield success. So my argument has been that the Republicans need to extend their brand not laterally but vertically, that they need to have a new politics that does appeal to college-educated whites and especially to college-educated women, who are now the majority of college graduates, of course. And that implies a softer line on social policy. That implies a more pragmatic line on some economic issues, and it implies a great emphasis on competence and the appearance of competence in governance. This is then to end up with the autobiography, which I don't think is of riveting interest to very many people, that this was the argument we had all through the healthcare debate, that I kept arguing in the website I edit in various columns, that I thought there was a deal to be done on healthcare. At any rate, if there wasn't a deal to be done, it was very important to die trying, to be seen like you were the people who went the extra mile. To try to produce something that was acceptable to you, and also, by the way, to prevent the Democrats from building into the plan a lot of the bad things that are in the plan. The plan is going to raise taxes on investment income. The plan is going to raise payroll taxes. It's going to hugely expand Medicaid, which is a great burden on state finance at a time that we're in the worst crisis in state finance since the Great Depression. There are a lot of things that are wrong with this plan that could, in my view, have been negotiated in any way it was worth trying. Healthcare bill passed without Republican votes in its Democratic form, I wrote a blog post that said there needs to be some accounting for this, that we have made a serious policy error for bad political reasons, and we need to learn some lessons from that. That blog post got a lot of attention, maybe too much, and the result is I'm very grateful for a free lunch. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's turn it over to the floor, and please do identify yourself when you ask your question. Please, right here.
Hi, Ishan Tharoor with Time Magazine. It's a question for both the panelists. And as we sort of talk about the long-term shifts in American demography, I was wondering how ought this impact electoral politics? It seems that in a increasingly multicultural and especially urban country, it seems a bit anachronistic to have, say, a caucus in Iowa to determine the presidential candidate for a party, or to be hand-wringing over a swing state in the Midwest, and the votes there, as opposed to votes in a big urban center. And can we expect in the coming decades a shift in thinking on this and some real political reform when it comes to this?
Rui, do you want to?
Well, it's a complicated set of questions. The first one about the Iowa caucuses is, it seemed out of step and incommensurate for years to... get feedback or something, or what's going on? People have been worrying about this for many years, and the reason why we can't get rid of it basically has to do with the nature of the way these institutions develop a momentum of their own, struggles within the party. Maybe someday we'll get rid of the Iowa caucuses, but for the time being, I think they will continue to outlast their plausibility as any kind of demographic indicator. The broader question about whether we'll be worrying so much about swing states in the Midwest, there's an easy way to answer that. We will be worrying less about them in the future, because the most important swing states are going to be in fast-growing areas of the country, not in slow-growing areas of the country. You know, the Colorado and Nevada are easier to fight about, or more important to fight about at this point maybe than say, Iowa. Also, I mean, there's a state like Arizona, which is potentially is adding electoral votes over time, whereas some of the states in the Midwest are losing them. And Arizona is very much a contestable state. In fact, you could even argue the state that's going to add the most electoral votes in the next two censuses, according to most projections, is Texas, which is projected to add 5 electoral votes. Now, you might think that's a complete boon for the Republican Party, and on the face of it, maybe it appears that way. The problem is that the reason why Texas is going to add these EVs is because of the strong growth in areas like Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, and Austin, in those thriving metropolitan areas. These are also areas of Texas that are trending blue and that could threaten over the next 5 or 10 years to turn Texas into, if not a blue state, at least a contested or purple state. Another way of looking at it is that 90% of the growth in Texas in terms of population is going to be from the Hispanic part of the Texas population. Again, something that would turn the state more purple. So I think your point is well taken, that as we think about the most important contested states in the future, I think they will cease to be these Rust Belt states in the Midwest, and increasingly we'll be talking about dynamic areas like the ones in the Southwest.
Is there anything you'd want to add to that, David?
I won't directly answer that, because I think I agree with some of those points. So just remember, Florida is the most important swing state right now, as we very dramatically saw in 2000. What tends to drive changes in the process is some perception that the process has failed, has brought about a bad result. And from the point of view of the two parties, they've been doing a pretty good, the parties can feel that each of them has done a pretty good job at its core business over the past few cycles, that both of them have delivered unprecedented levels of mobilization. I mean, John Kerry likes to point out that he got more votes than any Democrat in history, and by a lot, and of course he's right. Unfortunately for him, George Bush also got more votes than any Republican in history, and more than him. But the parties have been good at getting people to the polls, and they've been good at playing within a fairly narrow set of boundaries. The parties have both, I mean, we had 3 elections in a row where neither party was able to get a majority, partly because both sides did such a good job of holding down the other's vote. So as sort of market maximizing mechanisms, the parties can say, look, this process works. The question will be if one of the parties comes to feel that this is not working for us. The last big wave of changes occurred in the middle 1980s when Democrats began to think, we have to do something to stop us from nominating Walter Mondale ever again. If Republicans have a disaster of that scale in the near future, they may come to feel the same way. I mean, right now, it does look like the Republicans have some real worrying, from my point of view, worrying possibilities in the in their 2012 cycle. I mean, when you look at the people who are likely to run for president, regardless of your party affiliation, I think you would feel, if you look at that field, the one person, if you are dropped into the job tomorrow, that you would be fairly sure could do it would be Mitt Romney. Whatever you think of his other attributes, he could do it. But he can't get past the Iowa caucuses. He just can't. And he probably is going to have a lot of trouble in a lot of other places as well. And a lot of the other people who might look like plausible presidents are going to find themselves vetoed at various choke points along the way. Now, if the Republicans somehow, through collective rationality, end up putting together maybe not a winning but a plausible candidate, and that person gets 46-47% of the vote in a year that will look like a year of recovery, there may not be a great impetus of change. But if they gravitate to one of the more implausible candidates, and instead of getting 47-48% of the vote, that person gets much less, then I think you will have that same Walter Mondale, maybe we need superdelegates, maybe we need some other kind of change, question arising.
Keith, and then we'll come back to the floor.
Rui, I noticed the most surprising number I saw was that Asian Americans will rise from 5% to 9% of the electorate. We hear a lot more about the Hispanic vote. How are Asian Americans voting, and how, if at all, do you think that will affect U.S. policy towards China and the rest of the region?
Asians have basically become another base Democratic group. That wasn't true, actually, as late as the, early 1990s, but I think perhaps since the decline of communism is much of an issue, they've sort of shifted over to the Democratic Party on sort of grounds of relative social liberalism and relative economic liberalism. In the 2008 election, Barack Obama got 62% of the Asian vote. If you look at party identification data, Gallup this year shows Asians with a 37-point party ID advantage for the Democrats, and Hispanics with a mere 32 points. So actually, Asians are by almost any measure you'd care to name, one of the most progressive, solidly liberal groups in the United States. In fact, Asians are the only race-ethnic group where more people say they're liberals than say they're conservatives. That's not even true of African Americans, for example. So that's kind of interesting, and it does suggest that over time they will continue. They will have, as we saw from the data, they'll have an even greater influence on our politics. And to the extent that they would be oriented toward a more cooperative or open relationship towards South Asia, that could perhaps be a factor, though. Be cautious in reading that into the data at this point, but that's certainly a possibility.
Let me just say something quickly about the Asian catch-all. I mean, all of these catch-alls are very frustrating, but the Asian catch-all is the worst. It includes Iranian Americans, it includes Pakistani Americans, it includes Indian Americans, it includes all of the different diverse peoples from East Asia, it includes very affluent people from Japan, it includes much less affluent people from Laos and the Philippines. So you have to be really careful with that group. But that group, when it was much smaller and much more drawn from Japan and China and Korea, that group was a strong Republican group. Ronald Reagan did well with Asian voters, East Asian voters, both when he ran for president and even more when he ran for governor of California. And one of the reasons I think the Republicans may have trouble is that the Republican coalition used to be based in California, and Republicans always took special care to make sure they had a Californian on the ticket, or a Warren as vice president with Tom Dewey in 1948, Richard Nixon as vice president with Eisenhower, Nixon himself in 60, Reagan. When California dropped out of the Republican coalition between 1988 and 1982, a Sun Belt party became a Texas-led party. And politicians who had experience with dealing with the established East Asian populations of California became scarce. Just one more note about Ronald Reagan. One of the reasons Reagan did well was Reagan had been a very, in his Hollywood days, had been a very strong opponent. There had been a lot of restrictive covenants and segregation that especially affected Japanese and Chinese Americans. And Reagan, in his early political career, had been a long-stand campaigner against those. And one of his first acts as governor, in fact, was to name a highway after an American serviceman, whose name has just eluded me, who had been one of the early servicemen killed in World War II and who'd been denied burial in an American Legion cemetery in Southern California. And Reagan and his friend Jimmy Stewart had organized a big campaign to get this man buried in the American Legion cemetery, and then named a highway after him in memorial, and people thanked him. He was comfortable. Texas politicians are not going to have that kind of experience, or at least in the past have not.
Let's try and get two more questions. Joel and then Phil. Joel, go ahead.
Lincoln, PR, public affairs firm here, and we do some political life disclosure for America. I'm delighted to have you gentlemen here because it's great to hear that Republicans may move to the center. Not in my lifetime, maybe, but I don't know how long you have to hold your breath for that one. Look, I'm going to pose because you have lots of great history. I'll try and move as fast as I can on this one. Sorry about that.
Please.
I love your remarks about trends in the 80s, the 50s, and the 40s. Let's talk about personality, because I think, to a great extent, politics revolves around personalities. Alf Landon, Wendell Willkie, he'd have made a great president. Tom Dewey, Earl Warren, Nelson Rockefeller. Would these guys actually feel comfortable inside the Republican Party as we know it today, those giants? Do you have any personalities, names you can throw out to us that we can look forward for leadership as Republicans move to the center? Do we hold our breath?
At the senatorial and gubernatorial level, very much so. At the national level, look, there is a tendency that, speaking of trends, defeated political parties tend to recoil upon their political bases on the theory that if the voters said no to ham and eggs, it was because they wanted double ham and double eggs. And we will see this happen, for example, with the Labour Party in Britain after it loses. They will not take the conclusion, gee, I guess people like Blair more than they like Brown. Let's find another Blair. They're going to go look for a super Brown. And you saw this with Walter Mondale after Jimmy Carter, with Goldwater after Nixon. And I think the Republicans are very much in that mood. That said, let me point out that this is a party whose officials, whose elected officials are very different from this national image they're trying to create. I mean, think of people like Tom Campbell in California, who will likely win the Republican Senate nomination and has a fair chance of beating Barbara Boxer. Think of Mark Kirk, the Republican who's very likely to take Barack Obama's old Senate seat. And you can see a number of gubernatorial candidates as well. The big crisis in the Republican Party for these people is a crisis not of leadership, but of followership. That is, that it is difficult for a Mitt Romney to campaign as the man he is and as the president he could be. And in fact, he's now having to campaign on the slogan, "Nobody hates my health care plan more than I do."
Phil.
Philip Bowring. My question also relates to foreign policy. Regardless of which party gets into power, what do the demographics say about changes or the direction over time of policy, particularly towards the Middle East? Obviously, you know, support for Israel has been a cornerstone of U.S. policy for decades. You now have a situation where, although I see you quote the Jewish group specifically there, I believe there's many Muslims as there are Jews in America now, and a shift away from focus on events, you know, which stem from Europe in the last century to issues which may be more concern to a different demographic.
Let me take a swing at this. It is very hard for, this is a point that is always very hard to persuade non-Americans of, but American support for Israel has nothing to do with the Jewish vote. The Jewish population is tiny. It's in the wrong places. If every Jewish voter in New York voted Republican, it wouldn't make the slightest bit of difference. New York would still be a Democratic state, except for Florida, where the Jews are not that numerous, or not numerous enough. They don't swing electoral votes. The reason America supports Israel is because American public opinion massively supports Israel, and that has dramatically increased over the past 10 years. I think that that will likely subside as the perception of a threat to the United States from radical Islam, as and when the perception of a threat to the United States from radical Islam subsides. I don't see it changing very dramatically very soon, nor do I think it's very important whether it does or not, because I think the basic dynamics of the Middle East are not driven very much by American support. The Israelis have built a much more effective state than their neighbors and enemies, and the gap does seem to be growing. So it's going to be very hard for any, from a real politic point of view, for anyone to say, well, why should I oppose a settlement here that probably can't be done and probably won't work and certainly won't hold?
Rui, anything you'd like to add?
There's not a lot of age differentiation on these issues, as far as I've been able to tell. I think that while it's true that support for Israel is quite strong among the U.S. public, it's also true that there's not a lot of support for sort of current Israeli policy in terms of things like the settlements. I mean, there's a real desire for peace in the Middle East, and people are quite worried about these conflicts sort of going on forever. There's some signs that, at least if you look within, for example, the Jewish population, there's this organization called J Street that recently got established that is trying to have a sort of more alternative orientation toward trying to move U.S. Middle East policy in a certain direction. But that said, I think that it's probably true that what will cause Middle East policy to change has a lot to do with what happens in the Middle East and not so much U.S. politics, and perhaps certainly not so much the demographics of the U.S. as it's evolving. This is an issue I think that's hard to read off from the kinds of trends that I was talking about.
Gentlemen, we are right up against 2 o'clock, so I probably should wrap it up. Thank you both for coming, Rui and David. It's fascinating to hear your differing viewpoints. Please join me in thanking them for coming to the FCC today.
Thank you.
And as we do here, we have a little token of our appreciation. We've got a couple FCC shirts. We've got a red one for Rui and a blue one for David, because it is one happy family back in the States after all.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.